We're excited to announce that our very own podcasting platform, Zencastr, has become a new sponsor to the show. Check out the podcast discount link in our show notes and stay tuned for why we love using Zen for the podcast.
You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
This is the CRM Archaeology Podcast. It's the show where we pull back the veil of cultural resources management archaeology and discuss the issues that everyone is concerned about. Welcome to the podcast. Hello and welcome to the CRM Archaeology Podcast, episode 197 for September 9th, 2020. I'm your host, Chris Webster. On today's episode, we talk about unionizing with two people that have actually done it in Ontario, Canada. So get ready to take notes and stand up because you're worth it and because the CRM Archaeology Podcast starts right now. All right. Welcome to the show, everybody. For right now, it is just me today because we have a special recording at a special time, not our usual recording time. So most of the co-hosts of the CRMR podcast are off doing work and other things. But we wanted to bring in these two guests because they contacted me after hearing one of our episodes, which we'll talk about later and we'll link to in the show notes. But first, I want to introduce Sam and Joe. Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
So let's get to know you guys just a little bit. Sam, I'll have you go first. Tell us a little bit about yourself, where you're at right now, and what you're doing.
Absolutely. My name's Sam Easy. I've worked as a field tech in Ontario for about the last three or so years of my career in archaeology. I have a research license in Ontario. I have an MSc in archaeology. And I've been one of the leaders in the campaign to unionize Ontario archaeology for about the past 2 years. Mm-hmm. First, while I was working as a field tech who was just really and truly passionate about building a union for myself and for my crew, and later working as a staff organizer and as a union rep with LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America.
Awesome. And Joe.
Yeah. So my name is Joe Gull. I'm a union rep as well for LIUNA. I've been working in Ontario for a decade. I started as a field technician. I worked my way up to a field supervisor. I'm now professionally licensed in the province of Ontario. I acted as a field supervisor for a number of years before getting involved with the union. I'm one of the people who actually started the drive to unionize when I met Sam, and we worked together to get the word out and spreading. And now Sam and I are both employed full-time as archaeology sector representatives for LIUNA, organizing archaeology as well as negotiating contracts and dealing with things that come up after you negotiate a contract. So yeah, Sam and I are really excited to be here, and thanks for having us.
Yeah, no problem. So the reason you guys are here is because there was an episode we were looking at that you guys listened to from us that we'll link to in the show notes, where we talked about basically what does it take to unionize? What type of person does it take to unionize in archaeology? Because that question has been going around. I mean, I've been in archaeology for, I don't know, about 15 years now, give or take. And there's always a question of unionizing. And it's usually related around things like pay and benefits and stuff like that, you know, all the typical things. And that question sort of ebbs and flows. So why don't you first start talking about like why you decided to contact us and talk about this to our largely North American audience? I mean, we have an audience around the world typically, but this particular podcast is focused around North America, where really the United States and then more broadly North America. So what prompted from that episode for you to contact us and say, we've got some things to say about that?
We were actually passed on your podcast from one of our members who had listened to it and said, hey, this is a really interesting topic. You should listen to it. So Sam and I listened to it and we found it really interesting. And we wanted to reach out to, you know, explain to our peers in North America, you know, one, what it does take to unionize, two, that we actually have successfully unionized in Canada. Sam and I are both in Toronto, Ontario, mm-hmm. as well as what takes to maintain the union, as well as, you know, the ebbs and flows of the process. Because as you said, like, this has been a topic of conversation for years. I remember my first year of digging a square in, you know, the hot summer heavy clay, and everyone grumbling onto the job site, well, we need a union. Oh, we need healthcare. And, you know, that was 2010. And, you know, yeah. then you find out later that, you know, the people who are our managers are talking about it in the 80s and in the 90s. So it's a constant conversation of like, it wasn't ever going away. We were always talking about unionizing. So, you know, in 2018, we finally said, well, enough with the what about, let's actually do it.
Yeah, I think it was my third day in the work truck when I first started working in CRM, where my coworker just goes, oh, we need a union. And I think the question at that point, that was back in 2017, and, you know, why don't we have a union? So we wanted to reach out. I mean, the podcast talks about so many things related to work in archaeology, what it's like to work in CRM, to be in the field. You know, you've got episodes on fair wages, on harassment, on diversity, inclusion, working conditions, health and safety. And these are all things that, as union representatives, we're very interested in addressing, and we really are trying to address those head on in our negotiations. And just to get back to your question about why we reached out, you know, we see a title, The Kind of Person It Takes to Unionize, and I go, oh, geez, Joe, I wonder if they're going to describe us. And we decided to reach out because, to be honest, I think there were a few things that might have been missed or a few things that needed to be brought up, having, you know, being two people who've spent years organizing archaeology.
Yeah, especially like the question of the person it takes, it's not an individual. It really is everyone. It's one thing to say that, you sent the email, but you can't unionize one person. It really is everyone involved. So it's not the type of person, but it's the type of work landscape that you find yourself in that leads you to decide that a union is the best vehicle to resolve those workplace issues that Sam has just outlined.
That's great. And I'm glad you said it takes one person can't do it. I think often it takes the drive and will of one person to start and to gather people to their cause. And then, you know, it really does take an army to put something like that together. I'm sure of it. I mean, just the logistics alone and figuring it out. So let's talk about that to set a baseline of where you guys are coming from now. What does your union look like? We don't have to get into the weeds of how you guys unionized, although we might a little later on, but what is your union right now? What is the umbrella that the union is under? And, mm-hmm. and like, what do you guys, I guess, provide? What do you get from being part of the union?
Every union operates a little differently. So with LIUNA, we're part of a local called Local 3000. They have a head office in Hamilton, but they're truly, you know, across the country in a few different provinces. Our union sort of functions as a sector within the local. So we have a lot of autonomy. Joe and I spearhead a lot of things, but like he said, it's really about everyone at the table. So we have members who are negotiating with us, who are protecting the collective agreement, who are organizing their coworkers and their peers. So it's this huge group effort, but we are working as a sector within LIUNA Local 3000. And as part of that, what we do when we organize new companies, we help the members negotiate their collective agreements. We hold town hall meetings. We get input from people. We contact stakeholders within archaeology to get more information and to work with people as much as possible to improve archaeology, to improve the working conditions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And additionally, currently, we represent probably over 50% of the workforce in Ontario. That staff is, you know, your field archaeologists, your field supervisors, your lab technicians, your report writers, pretty much the whole gambit we do represent. And because archaeologists at every level want to be represented, they wanted to be a part of the union. And, right. you know, getting to this point in time, to get a little over 50%, it didn't take too long. It was about just over a year and a half, just shy of 2 years. And it really does go to show how desirable of a topic and a need this was in our province of Ontario. And I'm sure, archaeologists across North America can appreciate, because as we've outlined earlier, this is a topic of a conversation, not just in Canada, but pretty much everywhere.
Yeah. Well, and along those lines, so that's the other thing I want to know. So this is what your union does is, when people are having these conversations at the dig site or on survey or something like that, saying we need a union, just like you mentioned, Sam, what is expectations versus reality is what I want to know. You know, so everybody says we need a union, but very few people really understand what that means and what that's going to provide and how that works. So are people happy? Are they getting what they want out of the union? Or do you guys have some, you guys have a lot more work to do to, you know, start, you know, continuing those benefits and giving what you need to your members?
So it's always a battle. It's always an ongoing fight. But I mean, currently our members do have healthcare. Currently our members do have a pension. They are now getting paid a living wage. We go in with the expectations of saying operating a union is a really interesting idea when it comes to determining what the market can bear. And when I say that, I mean, if you charge way too much money, no one's going to hire you. So that means that your members aren't going to work. So you need to find that balance between what is the most that you can charge while still maintaining competitiveness, while you can still maintain providing these benefits and pensions to the field staff. So it is a balancing act. And, you know, to that point, it's something that we continually strive for. That's why, you know, you continually have these conversations with everyone to make sure that everyone's being taken care of. Everyone is getting access to those healthcare, that pension, and, you know, that representation and that higher wage. Sam can speak to this as well, because there's quite a change now with having a union firm and a non-union firm in the province of Ontario.
Yeah, so we're already seeing some pretty stark changes in the province. Just to go back to your question, are people getting what they want? Well, the reality is that a first collective agreement is one of the hardest you can negotiate. It's your first agreement. It's an entirely new foundation to start building upon. We took a lot of time at the beginning of this process to really talk to all our members, to talk to all the companies who had unionized and all the workers who wanted to turn archaeology and fieldwork in particular into a really solid career. We wanted to make a lot of changes to the way people were working and the conditions they were working under. So we did that consultation. Like Joe said, the things that came up, healthcare, huge one, pension, huge one. Also issues like job security, recall rights, fair wages, fair treatment, anti-harassment policies. So with all this information and all this input, we started negotiating. Did we get 100% of the things we asked for? No. Did we get a lot of them? Absolutely, we did. So there have been a lot of really significant changes, because unions, when they're negotiating fair contracts, they're not just negotiating for their own members. We're also making changes for all workers in a sector. So when we negotiate higher standards for work and higher standards for benefits and wages, the industry keeps up with us. The higher we raise the bar, the more space there is for people to raise their own conditions, even if they're non-union, because they have to compete for that labor, for people to come work for them.
And we see that in Ontario, where you know, these companies that are now offering healthcare and pensions because they're unionized, their competitors are now doing the exact same thing, because it's a game of, we want to attract the best archaeologists. How do we do that? Well, you have to compete against the union now. So you have non-union firms now providing healthcare, where previously they had never even thought about that. You have a raise in money for the hourly wage because they're trying to compete against the union. So Sam outlined it perfectly. When you organize a sector, you're really lifting up everyone, not just the people who are union.
Right. That's absolutely true. And, you know, it's interesting you say that too, because you guys were talking about negotiating wages and staying competitive and things like that. But isn't it funny that if everyone just raised their rates and stayed competitive, that all the bids would be competitive then?
Absolutely. Yeah.
That's the surprise.
Our logic, right? When we go into negotiations, that, you know, that's on us to be smart negotiators and to say, this is the average in the industry. This is what the markets can support. This is what we can ask for. This is how we raise the bar. It's not the easiest process, but it works. Having that information, we can negotiate fairer and fairer contracts. And I do want to add to that briefly that there is also a concern that, say, all the archaeologists in Ontario, we all get to the same table, we negotiate fair collective agreements, we raise the bar super high, we put it super high. One thing we hear from our community is that there's concerns about pushback. If archaeology becomes such an expensive industry, if it becomes too cumbersome, if it becomes too draining, sometimes people will say to us, oh, aren't we sort of creating an atmosphere where the government might try to reduce archaeology or to reduce heritage laws to try to accommodate that? And another thing that we've been really working on is advocacy. This concern about the reduction in the strength of heritage laws is not a concern if we are a strong, united union. And what we're always watchful for, what we're always cautious of, is making sure that we're advocating for strong protections for cultural heritage. We're advocating for complete excavations for sites. We're advocating for good ethical practice. And we want heritage laws to be strengthened, to be more robust and more protective.
And a part of that, because Sam brings up an excellent point there. When we come together collectively, when we have the workers, the employers, and the indigenous groups working together and being unified with one voice to advocate on the federal and provincial level to say that we don't want to see any shortfallings of the heritage law, that's a really powerful voice when you have those three groups speaking collectively with one voice to the government. I mean, we in Ontario, we have probably the strongest heritage laws across Canada, which mandate archaeology be done for every single development. That's why archaeology in Ontario is pretty thriving sector. So when you have those three groups unified with one voice and, you know, fighting for better heritage law and better conservation and better advocacy, you know, that's a really powerful tool that archaeologists had never tapped into before.
Well, for various reasons, we are going to take our first break right now, and we're going to come back and we'll be joined by another host of the CRMR podcast. And we're going to keep talking about this. And I want to talk about defining a few terms and then really talking about how you guys got this thing done. So, or at least got it started, because it's never done, right?
Never done.
No, it's 24/7 organizing for sure.
That's right. That's right. All right. So we will be back in just a second. In the meantime, please take a listen to these ads, because they're not technically, depending on when you're listening, they're probably ads for services on the Archaeology Podcast Network, although we are accepting advertising. If you're interested in promoting your jobs, promoting job openings, things like that, we can do dynamic regional-based advertising. So contact Madison at advertising@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com and help support archaeological education and outreach. Back in a second. Chris Webster here for the Archaeology Podcast Network. We strive for high quality interviews and content so you can find information on any topic in archaeology from around the world. One way we do that is by recording interviews with our hosts and guests located in many parts of the world all at once. We do that through the use of Zencastr. That's Z-E-N-C-A-S-T-R. Zencastr allows us to record high quality audio with no stress on the guest. Just send them a link to click on and that's it. Zencastr does the rest. They even do automatic transcriptions. Check out the link in the show notes for 30% off your first 3 months, or go to zencastr.com and use the code CRMARC. Looking to expand your knowledge of x-rays and imaging in the archaeology field? Then check out An Introduction to Paleoradiography, a short online course offering professional training for archaeologists and affiliated disciplines. Created by archaeologist, radiographer, and lecturer James Elliott, the content of this course is based upon his research and teaching experience in higher education. It is approved by the Chartered Institute for Archaeologists as 4 hours of training. That's in the UK, for those of you that don't know. So don't miss out on this exciting opportunity for professional and personal development. For more information on price and course structure, visit paleoimaging.com. That's P-A-L-E-O imaging.com. And look for the link in the show notes to this episode. Welcome back to the CRM Archaeology Podcast, episode 197. And right at the end of segment one, we were joined by Heather. Heather, how's it going?
I'm good. I'm excited about this topic. Hi, Joe and Sam.
Hi, Heather.
Hi, Heather. Welcome.
All right. So before we go much farther, I want to make sure we've got some terms and things defined, knowing full well that the way these terms are applied and possibly even defined could be different down here in the United States versus Canada, or even versus the province that you guys are in, right? So collective agreement is something you mentioned several times in the last podcast. And Sam, I think you mentioned that a few times, saying that was one of the big things that you guys have done and that you guys are continuously doing is working on these collective agreements. Can you explain what that means a little bit for, because we hear these terms thrown around all the time, but some people may not understand how this applies to you archaeologists trying to do these collective agreements for archaeologists in your province and in Canada. So can you explain exactly what that means in your guys' terms and how you get it together?
The short answer is that a collective agreement is a contract negotiated between a union and an employer that covers everyone in the workplace. So instead of having individual contracts, myself and my boss have a contract together. Instead, me and all of my coworkers would have the same contract that we would negotiate together. Mm-hmm. fundamentally, the long answer is that if you are, and I can only speak to Canada here, I don't understand the full labor legislation in the US, but fundamentally in Canada, you have the democratic right to choose whether you want to be represented in your workplace or whether you want to represent yourself. So you can choose whether you want to create an individual contract. You go to the boss, you say, this is the wage I think I'm worth. What can we negotiate? Or you have the right to go to a trade union or the rest of your coworkers and say, hey, if we all get together and we all get on the same page, we can create something that's a lot more fair for everyone involved. And that's fundamentally what a collective agreement is. It's a process of collective negotiation between everyone in the workplace.
And what we see out of that a lot of the time is when you have this collective organization, this collective action of all the archaeologists banding together and unifying to say, this is what we want, you know, you're going to get most of it. And to what Sam touched on earlier about a lot of the issues that you see in archaeology with harassment, discrimination, unequal pay, when you have a collective agreement in place, you know where you stand in that pay grid. You know that if as a field tech one, you are getting paid X, as a field tech two, you're getting paid Y, and there's no wage discrimination. So, and the best part about that is the archaeologists are negotiating, what is the classification of a field tech? What is the classification of a field supervisor? And if things go squirrely, if you think you're being harassed or discriminated, instead these things getting thrown under the rug like they had been in the past, we have grievance and arbitration legislation that says, should anything go squirrely, I can grieve it and the employer has to deal with it. And if they don't, I can go to a third party arbitrator and they'll deal with it. So you have all these extra protections for workers within a collective agreement. So to Sam's point, it is, you know, fundamentally your peers bargaining against the employer, but in a broader spectrum of it, it's all these extra rights that you have as a worker.
So let me try to elaborate on that a little bit, because in some of the conversations I've had, I think some people, and probably even myself, to be honest, I've never been part of a union, are possibly a little bit confused on the issue. So when you say these collective agreements are made between basically the employer and the union and to represent all the people that work for that employer, I've heard some people say that they were under the understanding that, like, if you unionize, a field tech makes this much money and gets these benefits regardless of where you're working. But it sounds like what you're saying is those actual agreements, benefits, pay structures are established for each employer, but you guys might standardize some terminology across the union. Is that right?
That's absolutely true.
Absolutely correct.
So collective agreements are negotiated based on the workplace. There's no sort of nebulous union standard that just exists. When a workplace is certified or when it's unionized, and the union has the right to represent staff there, what they'll do to set up negotiations is first they'll get all the staff together. They'll get input from everyone. Usually this is through like contract surveys or like one-on-one communication. Okay, what do you want to negotiate? What's your priority? What do you care about? What are you willing to back off on? And we get all that input. We set up a bargaining team of people in that workplace who come to the table with their employer, and we help them to negotiate their agreement. So it's always based in the workplace. There are variations based on differences that existed in the workplace prior to unionization. We negotiate up from where someone currently is. So it's a very flexible process. It's all based on communication and input with the people who are going to be under that contract and who are themselves negotiating that contract. So there's no sort of, if you unionize, this is your wage. That doesn't exist.
But yeah, absolutely. Ultimately, the people who are forming the union, each company that the field workers are forming a union, they are making those decisions. As Sam said, like, you have option A of having an individual contract or option B of going to a trade union and getting the vehicle of collective bargaining. LIUNA is just the vehicle that archaeologists have chosen. And I want to make that clear that archaeologists chose LIUNA. LIUNA did not choose archaeologists. We chose to be represented by LIUNA because for a myriad of reasons, but we ultimately want to have that vehicle to make these decisions for ourselves at the bargaining table so that each contract is representative of what we want to see in our contract, in our employment. And yes, we can standardize some language and we can, you know, make things easier so that, you know, if you're transferring between companies that are union, you know, the transition may or may not be a little bit easier, but those are the ultimate goals.
I'm a little familiar with police unions, and this, you know, this does sound pretty familiar with, you know, as far as the collective bargaining within the each police union is a department that's separate in and of itself. Same thing I can see with the companies here that you guys have set up. So as far as a union goes, sometimes it does not include part-time or as needed individuals. And that is, I'm not familiar with Canada, but that is a large portion of the workforce for archaeologists are as needed. So how do you fold those in?
So if I could just clarify, there's really no way of accurately comparing the example you used, a police union, to a union like ours, which are archaeology companies operating in the private sector. Police unions are in the public sector. Right away, that's a huge difference. Secondly, a union is really nothing more than a group of workers who have collective problems that they want to address together. So there's no set standard for what union has to be. Union has to do this. There's no way to take from one collective agreement, like, for example, a police union, and say, because they do this, because they exclude part-time, because they include part-time, then our union over here must do that.
Right.
When a union applies to represent people and to allow them to unionize, they'll include what's called a bargaining unit description. So for us in Ontario, a union would have to go to the labor board and say, hey, all these folks in this classification of this company want to be members of a union. We believe they have a shared interest in the workplace and they should be under the same contract. Can we represent them?
Hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I mean, I understand the difference between public and private, obviously, but what my concern is that, you know, that is a large portion of the workforce. And so you generally did answer that question.
So to expand on that a little bit, archaeology in Ontario, opposed to other provinces in Canada, and I'm sure in the States, our workforce is pretty well seasonal. So you can work 40 hours a week for almost 8 months until the snow flies. Because mm-hmm. the heritage laws in Ontario are so strong, which means that archaeology has to be done for every single development, we have a really strong sector and a really strong industry of archaeologists. So to Sam's point, our union agreements could represent part-time, full-time, seasonal, whatever the caveat you want to use. But because our workforce is largely able to work full-time hours for an 8-month period of time, we ensure that our collective agreements are reflective of that nature so that we have recall rights so that, you know, if you're in the off season in the winter and you're not doing lab analysis, you're not writing reports, that you have your job back in the spring to go continue doing work. You don't have to worry about reapplying. You don't have to worry about going to another firm. You know that you have job security. So you have those recall rights. And we've negotiated that into our collective agreements because we know that the seasonality of, you know, working in Canada where, you know, it snows for 4 months of the year. So we have that coverage in our collective agreements. I don't know if that answers your question further.
Yeah, I know. Yes, it does. And I'm not that familiar with how I'm pleased to hear that there is that much work. That's terrific in Canada. So how do I don't know as far as unions, if you have seen that with other environmental technicians, such as biologists. I mean, are there unions for biologists in Canada? Okay. So this is, it's interesting. You know, I could see this being a breakout move for archaeologists because, and it's not going to be easy because I haven't heard of any unions for any of the in other environmental technicians or consultants.
For sure.
We can't really speak to that right now. That's not part of our assignments. We're not field biologists. So unfortunately, we're not aware of any union that exists for field biologists or environmental technicians right now. And we can't really speak to that.
No, I'm not talking about starting a union for biologists. What I'm saying is the kickback, the groups that are not going to be for union in the U.S. and how this could really affect the business of CRM in the long run. I'm just looking at the different potential challenges mm-hmm. to starting unions in the U.S., one being, you know, the comparable workforce for other environmental specialties. You know, there aren't unions for them. That would be one opposition, and one of a myriad of opposition. So I'm not certainly not against the concept. I'm just trying to figure out, you know, the hurdles before those hurdles are even attempted.
Yeah, Heather, I mean, you raise an excellent point. I mean, one of the hurdles we had in Ontario and Canada is that you're right, there aren't unions for field technicians of, you know, whether it be field biologists, terrestrial ecologists, you know, whatever the case may be, archaeologists. So when we started this, we knew we were getting into uncharted waters when it came to, you know, we're going to have a union that's for archaeologists exclusively. How do we navigate those waters? And when we reached out and we picked LIUNA to be the union to represent us, there was a lot of research done on both ends. It was 4-5 months of research on our end. So myself and Sam and a number of other key leaders who decided to pursue this endeavor, as well as LIUNA doing their research on our sector to be, one, can this be sustaining? Two, can LIUNA properly represent field workers? And three, is this the right thing to do for our industry? And when we came together for a large meeting, me and a number of the executives, and you know, we decided that, yeah, the answer to all those questions was, yes, we can do this. This is going to happen. We kicked off the campaign in June of 2018. And from June till now, we represent 6 firms and over 50% of the industries, because, you know, this is a niche that archaeologists want. This is a niche that archaeologists need. So I'm sure if, you know, biologists or terrestrial ecologists want to do this, they have that access too, but it's going to take someone in that sector who has an understanding of how that works to come forward to, you know, lead the charge, because yeah, Sam and I are not biologists, and we wouldn't even know where to start.
Are there, when it comes to, I'm sure you have a stratified, you know, concept as far as, you know, field tech one and crew supervisor and all these. Do you have these set up, the definitions are set up with a certain amount of hours within that position? How does that work?
Yeah, this is also something that we negotiate in consultation with the staff. So usually we'll meet with the members, we'll see what exists right now, like what are the classifications, what are the tiers, are these fair tiers, what requirements are there to get into the next tier up, what's your annual increase? So what we've been doing is creating wage grids that are negotiated between the members and between management. And we think that we hit on a fairer middle ground for all these wage grids. We find what's a fair wage. What requirements do you need? Do you need a license? Do you need an education? Do you need X amount of hours? Largely, we also include seniority in this as well. How long have you been working in the field? But there's no sort of a set number of hours required. It's very variable. Like Joe said, this is a very seasonal job. So our wage grids are set up to accommodate that really seasonal workflow.
And I should specify that because it is seasonal, and we cannot control the weather, especially in southwestern Ontario, being union is not a guarantee of hours. Right. I can't begin to control the weather. And if I could, then that would be a whole different serious career opportunity. So
we have made appeals to the labor board about the weather. We haven't done that.
Yeah, it's one of those things where, you know, we're working within our means. We understand that it's a seasonal job. We understand that, you know, people want to be archaeologists for their careers. So how do we do that? How do we accommodate a seasonal job to a career? So mm-hmm. that's the hurdles that we're going through. And currently, Sam and I and, you know, all our members, we're unified and we're fighting for these things because, you know, so far we do have the pension, we do have the healthcare, we do have the recall rights, but, you know, there's a lot more to go. This is just the tip of the iceberg.
All right, so that's a good point to stop on. So let's take our final break for this podcast and come back and wrap up this discussion with Sam and Joe about unionizing in segment 3. Back in a second. You may have heard my pitch for membership. It's a great idea and really helps out. However, you can also support us by picking up a fun t-shirt, sticker, or something from a large selection of items from our Tee Public store. Head over to arcpodnet.com/shop for a link. That's arcpodnet.com/shop to pick up some fun swag and support the show. Welcome back to the CRM Archaeology Podcast, episode 197, and we are talking to Sam and Joe, who helped set up and are organizing the Archaeologists Union up in Ontario, Canada, and we're talking to them about, you know, what it took to do that. And what I want to talk about now is the thing that I think always comes up the most when you hear talks about unionizing down here in the United States, whether it's in some of the Facebook groups we're in, Archaeo Field Techs, things like that. It's always, well, I'm going to get fired, or, you know, my firm or myself will get blacklisted if I try to unionize and join a union. And there have been attempts. I've never really talked to anybody that started that, but there have been attempts to start some sort of field tech union or something like that in the past. And clearly they haven't been successful because they're not around right now. And, or at least they're not vocal if they are around. So what did you guys experience when you were doing that? You both seem relatively young compared to other archaeologists in the field. Were you concerned with any sort of backlash when you first started really having these conversations and then you were elected by your peers to, you know, keep this thing going and keep it going in the future? And has there been any backlash since then? Anything really negative about this?
So labor law in Ontario is very strong, in Canada as well. It is your democratic right to want to be represented by a union. And because of that, if a company is going to, you know, fire you, discipline you, or do anything untoward, that's what we call an unfair labor practice. And you can be taken to court. And if you are represented by a union, that union will represent you at the Ontario Labor Relations Board. And so there's examples where people might have had some level of negativity towards them, and you know, you would file an unfair labor practice and then that would get resolved. So labor law is really important for us. But to your point about what was the reception, you know, there were some organizations that, you know, were kind of skeptical of a union on the onset. I mean, they weren't waving the union flag, that's for sure, but you know, having these conversations with those groups and explaining to them what we're doing, what we're standing for, and how we want to accomplish this, you know, we change their minds. They become, I don't want to say a champion for us, but they say, okay, I get it. This isn't out to harm the industry. Sam and I and all the other archaeologists who have unionized, we're trying to make this industry better. And we're doing that by unionizing, by having this solidarity and this unity. And when you explain that to everyone and you explain that to the people who don't think this is a good idea, they get it. So it's just having those conversations and breaking down all their questions and their misconceptions and just saying, you know, we're not the boogeyman. We're not here to destroy archaeology. We're archaeologists before anything else. Sam and I are both archaeologists.
I would say the majority of times what Joe and I do is we just spend our time speaking to people in our community. We educate and we empower people. To go back to your question about fears of blacklisting, I really don't think that largely happened here with us. We're a small community. Archaeologists in Ontario are quite tight-knit. There was lots of communication going on between companies, between workers, and even between management and workers about how we could use the process of unionization to improve things. Did we have pushback? Yeah, we absolutely did. It's fairly common for an employer to express an opinion about unionization when a vote is triggered, when a vote's going on to unionize. And employers can express negative opinions. They can say, I'd really like that you not unionize. But like Joe said earlier, our labor laws are much stronger up here, and workers' rights to unionize are more robustly protected, unfortunately, than they are in the States.
Now, there's laws, and then there's perceptions of people. And I think that's what people are concerned with down here in the States, too. You know, we have laws in certain things that, you know, not as robust as the ones you guys have, of course, but we do have some things that would technically protect you in certain circumstances, but it doesn't protect you from your peers saying, don't trust that guy. They want to unionize. You know what I mean? And I'm trying to get a gauge of the attitude, the general attitude towards unionizing as best you guys can say it. Obviously you don't know the attitude of every single archaeologist there, but the general air seemed to almost favor unionizing versus not. Whereas here it kind of favors unionizing, but nobody thinks it'll ever happen.
That's the hard thing. If no one is ever going to step out from the crowd and say it's time to change something, then a campaign won't get going. You really need those people who are willing to stand up and say, this is what I think is right. This is what I think needs to change. And I'm sick of the way the industry is. It's ultimately a choice that you have between things staying the same as they are currently with the conditions that you've described on your podcast that we've talked about here today, wage discrimination, harassment, unfair treatment, being fired without warning, health and safety violations in the field. Are you okay with those conditions remaining the same for the entirety of your career or until you're forced to quit? Or are you willing to be the person who says, I'm in support of a union?
Absolutely. And you know what? Sam brings up an excellent point. It's the people who are standing up in the crowd who say, I have had enough of this. And I can guarantee you, we have a lot of our members who will listen to this podcast and they're shaking their heads. Yeah, that's me. And to all those people who I can't name because there's too many of you, you guys did a great job and like my hat's off to you, but it's a community effort. Yes, it took a couple people to step up and have that conversation, but it really, it's that unifying force between everyone. It's the archaeological grapevine of spreading these ideas. Because as Sam said, like archaeology, for whatever reason, we're all highly educated, yet we're get these bad ideas of, you know, harassment, sexual harassment, verbal harassment, wage discrimination. And it happens everywhere. So how do we fix that? Mm-hmm. And like, how do we fix the burnout? Because in archaeology, before we had the union, an archaeologist would only last maybe 3 years in the field before they had to go get quote unquote the real person job. And you talk about that in episode 177, where you're saying, you know, these people should get a minor in geology or a minor in GIS. Well, why is that? It's their exit strategy out because the industry sucks.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So how do we make archaeology a career? It's the only way of doing it is by collective action, by working together to, you know, get the things that will make this a career. We're all archaeologists here. Let's continue being archaeologists. Let's not be a geologist or a GIS technician. Right. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but let's be archaeologists first.
And if I can just go back very quickly, the history of the labor movement really made some of its biggest strides. Unions made some of the biggest progress for workers universally under some of the most deplorable working conditions, under working conditions where people could be attacked or killed for being in support of a union, they could be blacklisted, they could be kicked out of their industry. People made the biggest strides, and it all came down to that solidarity between people working in the industry who wanted to see something better.
You know, first of all, I do want to correct maybe a misnomer here. We do have, it's called the National Labor Relations Act in the U.S. that forbids employers from interfering with unionizing and any movement towards that. So we are protected here in the U.S. to do that. I do think that, you know, a lot of people at this point, it's just not organized enough in the U.S. People do not realize, and, you know, those of us that are archaeologists and we've worked in the field many years, we know there's a lot of big talk in the field, and there's a lot of people that, you know, if I had this, I would be doing that. And, you know, but nobody really sits down and approaches it from a really smart and organized fashion, such as you guys have done, and you're equipping others to do the same. You know, I do think overall, coming from a hiring position, it is very frustrating to have, you know, a population, you have terrific techs, and then you have some people that, you know, they've been, the lack of organization has probably promoted certain people with a less of a desire to improve themselves from still continuing to be in the field, and it has not promoted, you know, a betterment of people's skills and professional behavior. So I do believe that, you know, a union, there is a positive aspect of that, having a little bit more of a defined expectation of how people, instead of just what the employer expects from you, which is very difficult, as we all know, to really to understand an employee until what they've been on the field for a few months, you know, then you really get a true sense of their work ethic and their skill set. It's very easy to say that you know how to handle a Trimble. I'm not going to find out that you really don't until you've been out in the field and you've been putting your hand.
Can I ask you a question?
Sure.
So coming from that perspective, and you've outlined it perfectly, you know, this disparity of, you know, of workers, as someone who does hire, would you see a benefit to having a unified workforce that has, you know, that they're trained, you know, that they have their credentials, and you know that, you know, based on their track record of working as a cohesive unit, would you find that beneficial as an employer to have this unified base of skilled workers?
Absolutely. If you have, my brother-in-law is an electrician. So there's a very specific set of requirements that electricians have to meet in timing and in skill set and their ability to prove what they can and cannot do. You know, they're not going to be promoted to the next level until they can prove and confirm that they do have this skill set. And as an employer, that would be a lot easier for me in hiring, for me to know what it is that I'm truly dealing with. It is, in many ways, it's a crapshoot. And unfortunately, you can have people that have been working in the field for so many years, they have so much, their skill set is enviable. But then they're still put in this quote-unquote category of field tech, right? And in archaeology, we, unfortunately, and it's wrong, but especially from the hiring perspective, there are, you know, people have this idea, they just put somebody in the field tech category and they don't differentiate between a field tech who's just been in the field for and has maybe two field schools under the belt and somebody who is a seasoned field tech, you know. And there's a lot of people that can lie on resumes or can exaggerate on resumes. And to be able to have a process where people are actually testing into different levels and skill set categories would be immensely helpful. Mm-hmm.
So I think what you're talking about are professionalization, standardization, and actual clarity about skills and background and experience. And that's something that we completely agree with. When we started our campaign, we really honed in on three things we wanted to change. We wanted greater professionalization. We wanted standardization because of the same disparities you just described, Heather. And we wanted to be able to advocate for ourselves. So we're working on the advocacy. We're working on the standardization. We're working on the professionalization by looking and creating courses and training programs that we hope to one day be able to give to union members to bring them up to the standard point of training. So if you're going out into the field, you've had at least X amount of training. You know how to recognize XYZ in Ontario. You have familiarity with the process of consultation in Ontario. You understand how to go out to work and to do your work well. And that's really something we're fighting for as well.
And one of the things to pick up on that is with the pandemic currently ongoing, we've transitioned to a lot of webinars to teach our members while they're working remotely. One of the things we did was LIUNA has a number of partnerships with Indigenous communities across Canada. And we were able to facilitate with one of the Indigenous communities to provide cultural sensitivity training for our members so that, you know, you have an Indigenous group telling our archaeologists, here's the do's and don'ts of working as an archaeologist. Mm. Something that we're able to facilitate as a union, because when we work together, we have all this extra ability to, you know, get things done rather than an individual.
That is an excellent point that, you know, in the back of my mind, we all think about, but to actually have it organized in a way, not only do you have from a hiring perspective, you have the employer that is looking for a set group of skills, but then you have this internal expectation among the archaeologists that, you know, we don't want it just to be driven by what our employer wants. We want it also driven by our own sense, our own inner sense of professionalism, such as, culture awareness, those types of things where we're not only promoting what the employer is driving, but we're also promoting what archaeologists want to see improve, you know, the professional workforce.
Absolutely. We want to be proud of the work we're doing. We want to achieve a really high quality of work. We want ongoing professional development opportunities. We want to improve our skill set. Ultimately, we also want to ask for better working conditions and better wages and benefits. So we want to work harder to earn those. We want to be worth a really solid wage. We want to be worth a career.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right. So we are running out of time on the segment. I want to wrap this up by just saying, Sam and Joe, first off, thanks for coming on here. This has been highly informative and educational for us, and I hope our listeners get a lot out of this. You guys took a lot of notes on, you know, when you listened to our episode 177, which we're linking to in the show notes, where we talked about what kind of person does it take to unionize, basically. What is one thing, and I'll start with Sam, what is one thing that you guys can, that you can think of that we haven't addressed in this that you just need to get out that you want everybody to hear that is probably your big takeaway from all this or something we just didn't talk about? Sam, go ahead.
Sorry, do you mean about the kind of person it takes to organize or just what I want to take away?
I think either one, whatever you think is the biggest thing to have a conversation about here for this non-unionized United States, if you could basically say one thing to the people listening to this that are thinking we should unionize and we haven't talked about it yet, what's the thing that you want them to know?
I think unions come from compassion. They come from a drive within the workers who are doing that work. I think if there's going to be a labor movement for archaeology in the US, it's going to come from the field staff. If you're a person who feels really passionate about the work, if you care about what you're doing, if you want to make it better, and if anything I'm saying is resonating with you, then my best advice is to just start organizing. Anyone can be an organizer. You can teach yourself. You can educate yourself. Anyone can reach out to trade unions. Anyone can contact a labor organizer to ask for help, to ask for advice. Start getting in contact with people. Start building lists of connections, people you can call, people you can talk to. You can ask other people in your community, hey, are you on board? We're gonna get this rolling. Here's how we do it.
Hmm. Awesome. Joe?
I think one of the main things to take away from this conversation is be willing to stand up in a crowd. Be willing to take that leap of faith. We've talked about it in segment one. We've talked about it in segment two, and we're talking about it right now. We've been talking about unionizing for years. It's been something mm-hmm. that archaeologists have always grumbled about, and it's something that we've always wanted. Let's do it. Mm-hmm. Enough of the like what ifs. You know, the only way something's going to happen is if you get up and you do it and you commit to it. And with the unity that we have as a sector, as a profession, as a group of individuals, archaeology is a small community across the globe. We have that solidarity with each other. We have that unity. It's just acting upon that and, you know, willing to stand up in a crowd.
Awesome. Well, that is a great note to end on. And again, thank you guys for coming on and relaying your experience. And I think we're more than likely going to have you guys on again so we could just keep asking questions. And I think to help drive that, maybe we can have the listeners of this particular episode send us in your questions for Sam and Joe, and we'll collect all these together. And maybe in another month or two, we'll try to have you guys on again and answer some of the listener questions, because I'm sure Heather and I didn't ask everything. Well, we didn't even ask everything we wanted to ask. So
exactly. We'd be happy to come back.
That sounds great.
One thing okay. I can point to, we do have a website, archaeologyunion.com. Mm-hmm. And it does have a section on that website with frequently asked questions. So if we didn't answer them, it's on that website.
Fantastic. We will have that in the show notes. So again, thanks a lot, guys. And thanks, everybody, for listening. And please send in those questions, chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Or you can use the contact form on the website or any of the other contact information on the show notes for any of these episodes. You can get a hold of us through Facebook, Twitter, a number of ways. All right. Thank you again. And we'll be back next time.
Thanks, everyone.
Thanks, Joe and Sam. Appreciate it.
That's it for another episode of the CRM Archaeology Podcast. Links to some of the items mentioned on the show are in the show notes for this podcast, which can be found at www.arcpodnet.com. facebook.com/crmarkpodcast. Please comment and share anywhere you see the show. If you'd like us to answer a question in a future episode, email us. Use the contact form on the website or just email chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Support the show and the network at arcpodnet.com/members. Get some swag and extra content while you're there. Send us show suggestions and interview suggestions. We want this to be a resource for field technicians everywhere, and we want to know what you want to know about. Thanks to everyone for joining me this week. Thanks also to the listeners for tuning in, and we'll see you in the field. Goodbye.
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 Goodbye, folks.
This show is produced and recorded by the Archaeology Podcast Network, Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle, in Reno, Nevada, at the Reno Collective.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
Thanks again for listening to this episode and for supporting the Archaeology Podcast Network. If you want these shows to keep going, consider becoming a member for just $7.99 US a month. That's cheaper than a venti quad eggnog latte. Go to archpodnet.com/members for more info.